This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Ihe Swuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
What the nutrition survey revealed was that up to half of all children under five in parts of northeast Nigeria are acutely malnourished. That means if they don't get food, if they don't get treatment, they are at risk of dying from malnutrition.
That's Greg Ram, Vice President for Humanitarian Response for the charity Save the Children. We'll have full details on the story coming up.
Also, human rights groups warn Burundi is at risk of genocide, and combating international terrorism in the Middle East could be one of the major problems President-elect Donald Trump may have to tackle.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, up to half of all children in northeastern Nigeria are malnourished. That's the finding of a new survey from the international charity Save the Children. It's feared that 200 children could die every day from hunger. The region is trying to recover from years of attacks from the terrorist group Boko Haram. The organization carried out screenings between June and October and regularly found between 40% to 50% of children undernourished. They say the figures could even be worse in areas out of reach because of insecurity. Greg Ram is Vice President for Humanitarian Response for Save the Children in Washington. He says hunger threatens to overwhelm a desperately underfunded humanitarian response.
What the nutrition survey revealed was that up to half of all children under five in parts of northeast Nigeria are acutely malnourished. That means if they don't get food, if they don't get treatment, they are at risk of dying from malnutrition. These statistics put together suggest that over 75,000 children could die over the next year from acute malnutrition if something's not done today to address this problem.
What needs to be done today to try to help with this situation?
Well, several things are needed. Children who are malnourished need to be identified. They need to receive intense food that is needed for acutely malnourished children. And those with medical complications need to be treated in stabilization centers, essentially intensive care units. But right now, this is an underreported and underfunded humanitarian crisis. What's needed in order for that to happen is for the international community to come together and support the people of northeast Nigeria in meeting the needs of these malnourished children.
Why is the humanitarian response so underfunded right now?
It's a common story in humanitarian crises. There are some that are in the headlines, and there are others that are sort of out of view. And right now, the crisis in northern Nigeria is one of the most underreported. It's not in the headlines. And when it's not in the headlines, it doesn't attract the funding. It doesn't attract the world's attention. And Save the Children is calling on the world to pay attention the crisis affecting children in northeast Nigeria.
Also, your country director for Nigeria visited some of the intensive care units there in northeast Nigeria. So what did he see regarding the children, and what were the moms saying?
What Ben saw when he was up there is an intensive care unit that we run for malnourished children with medical complications that is overcrowded, that has more children in it than there are services available. What he saw were so many mothers coming whose husbands had been killed in the fighting and who may have lost other children and are bringing their youngest. The case of a mother who's brought a one-year-old girl to our stabilization center. Her husband was killed. Her other child, who was two, had died of measles. And there she is left with her only child, trying to get the help that she needed. This story is repeated again and again, including in places that are inaccessible at the moment due to the fighting. What we need is to find a way to make sure that all children who need assistance, who are not getting the food they need, can get the support they need to survive.
And also for some of these children, even though they are still so young, under five, this is not the first time that they are going through a hunger crisis, so they're already dealing with weak bodies.
Well, one of the challenges, the insurgency and the fighting has been going on for 7 years in northeast Nigeria, and so people have been on the move. Over a million children are displaced due to the fighting. And therefore, you know, a child can be identified as malnourished, can for a moment, a few months, find some respite, find some care, find some food, And then a year later, they moved again. And so their bodies are weak from this constant movement, from previous bouts of illness and malnutrition. Simply, it's difficult to survive year after year in these circumstances.
Where do you see this crisis a few months from now unless action is taken to help the situation?
Well, we certainly hope that action will be taken. But if action is not taken, 75,000 children are at risk of dying from acute malnutrition in northeast Nigeria over the coming year. That's simply not acceptable in this day and age. We know how to help malnourished children. We know the kind of food they need. We know the kind of treatment they need for those who are in the most severe situations. What the world needs to do is to respond to these children in need.
That was Greg Ram, Vice President for Humanitarian Response for Save the Children. He spoke with me from Washington.
Millions of people in northeast Nigeria are in need of humanitarian aid after a seven-year insurgency by Boko Haram militants. But response to the crisis is being complicated by accusations that food aid is being stolen and money wasted by aid workers. The allegations come from Nigerian officials and some of the millions of people who've been displaced by the conflict between Boko Haram and regional militaries. To learn more, VOA's David Arnold talked to reporter Isaac Linus in Abuja, who has visited camps for the displaced.
The humanitarian crisis in northeast Nigeria has proven a monumental task in three states where Boko Haram militants once pillaged the countryside. The extremists continue their battle with Nigeria and its regional allies, but their attacks are fewer and often rely on suicide bombings. Reporter Isaac Linus recently visited the region to view the relief effort and hear from its critics. First, he talked to the displaced.
IDPs are still complaining of going hungry, but yet you see long trucks of aid materials being shipped into all these places, going into Maiduguri, long trailers, long trucks of foodstuffs. But the funniest thing is that the IDPs are still complaining. They complain, you hear stories about how aid camp workers divert food from foodstuffs and other things meant for these IDPs. They divert it into their own private pockets, into their own private houses.
Linus says the people who were supposed to receive the food and the health care witnessed the stealing. They know who the thieves are.
They are pointing, accusing fingers at them directly and saying, you, there are instances they even mention names. This one and this one yesterday, they put bags of rice at the back of their cars in the night and they drove it out of the camp. They are pointing fingers at government, at camp officials, and the camp officials are mostly government workers. Yeah, both Borno State and the federal government.
Linus has been to many of the camps in and around Maiduguri, but he says people claim theft and corruption are everywhere.
Across all camps, are you talking about Bakassi camp? Are you talking about Mondu Garage camp? Are you talking about across all camps, particularly in Maiduguri? All these complaints are there. They are complaining. The IDPs are complaining.
While most of the accusations have been leveled at camp workers, some lawmakers in Abuja claim that top officials in the federal government are also guilty.
The Secretary General of the government was accused. He has been in the news for this issue. According to issues, stories coming out that he was given large amounts of money, millions of nairas, and that was misappropriated. The issue about misappropriation of funds in this issue of IDP is not hidden. Everybody knows that most of the people that these funds come into their hands, at the end of the day, one way or the other, these funds get misappropriated. When the Senate met, they decided they were going to probe that story that the SGF was involved in.
Corruption is not the only charge. Governor Kashim Shettima of Borno State says the UN has wasted funds on what he calls luxury, such as armored cars.
He's complained that basically the amount of money that has been announced by the UN and other humanitarian bodies that has been expended on helping the IDPs, you know, that it is not commensurate to what is seen on ground. And I have also spoken to government officials, people who are close to the governor. They actually say that this is true, that most times the humanitarian organizations, they spend most of the monies on trying to give themselves luxurious living conditions in Maiduguri, in good luxurious hotels, to buy armored vehicles. According to their concern, the priority should be the IDPs, not aid workers coming trying to provide themselves to a lot of luxury.
The UN disagrees with that assessment and has given Linus its side of the story.
I've also spoken to UN officials. One said directly that the governor does not know what he's saying. The man just cited an example about a few months ago when a UN convoy was attacked. If it was not that they were in armored vehicles, a lot of them probably would have been killed. They are in this environment. They need to protect themselves by going into armored vehicles. They need to stay in accommodations where they are secured so that they can get their jobs done. That they went ahead to explain that if the humanitarian agencies were not in Maiduguri would have been a catastrophe right now.
Beyond the political debate, the work continues to rebuild the lives of 2 million Nigerians who live in tents while their children suffer from malnutrition, cholera, and other life-threatening diseases. David Arnold, VOA News, Washington.
Human rights groups warn the tiny African country of Burundi is at risk of genocide. Their call for international motivation came in a newly released report that documents widespread abuses under the government of President Pierre Nkurunziza. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
Burundi descending into chaos, pulled apart by ethnic hatred that fuels mass killings, even genocide. This isn't happening right now, but a movie trailer released by rights groups under the hashtag #StopThisMovie suggests it's possible.
We are not saying that the genocide is coming now. We are explaining that all the mechanism, all the intention, and all the bodies of the repression are ready to commit a possible genocide.
Florent Gilles is Africa director for the Paris-based umbrella group International Federation for Human Rights. A joint report with Burundian rights group Iteka describes killings, tortures, rapes, and disappearances in Burundi since popular protests erupted last year against President Pierre Nkurunziza's bid for a third term. The report says more than 1,000 people have died, hundreds have gone missing, and thousands more are being detained or fleeing the country. It says many of the abuses were committed by youth militias and government security forces. The groups are calling for an international peacekeeping mission and political dialogue to resolve the crisis.
Each day, a few people are arrested, disappeared, are killed. This is not a massive violation where all camera is coming. But this is a daily violation.
Iteka's president, Ancher Nikuyagize, currently lives in exile in Uganda.
Le gouvernement a commencé un recensement ethnique où
He says a new government census counts among the tools aimed at getting Hutus to side with the government and turn a political conflict into an ethnic one in a country scarred by a history of ethnic killings. United Nations investigators have also warned of risks of a genocide in Burundi, and the International Criminal Court is considering a full investigation into alleged atrocities. The government, which denies its forces are involved in abuses, recently announced it was pulling out of the ICC. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580, and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 19 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. A new survey indicates up to half of all children in northeastern Nigeria are malnourished. And human rights groups warn Burundi is at risk of genocide. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
One of the major problems that Donald Trump will take on when he becomes president includes combating international terrorism in the Middle East.
During his campaign, he pledged to work side by side with U.S. friends in the Middle East, including Israel, Jordan, and Egypt. Among those weighing the challenges facing Mr. Trump is Ambassador Alberto Fernandez. He's the former director of the State Department's Center for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed Elshenawy about stopping the spread of terrorism in the larger Middle East region.
Obviously, it's in early days. The challenge is going to be for a new administration like that of President-elect Trump to focus on goals that can be achieved. You know, the United States is now involved in fighting terrorists in the greater Middle East area in six countries: Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Yemen, and Libya. So the challenge is to prioritize and to be able to get some wins, some definitive wins against the terrorist organizations, whether Daesh or some of the Al-Qaeda branches.
How about extremist groups in Africa like Al-Shabaab and Boko Haram?
Definitely. You know, there is a counterterrorism operation going on with already a mature one going on against Al-Shabaab. The one with Boko Haram is newer and slower, but it's, I think, definitely one that can be prioritized. It's one of those areas where there's a possibility to ratchet up quickly and maybe get some good results.
He continued to consider vetted Syrian refugees as a potential terrorist threat in the making. What is your take on that?
Well, I mean, there's always a challenge. I'm a refugee myself, and there's always a challenge of people coming to America, that people love it and not hate it. We've had certainly examples of people who came to the United States as refugees or asylum seekers, like the Tsarnaev brothers, like people from Somalia and the cluster of people who joined Al-Shabaab and ISIS in the Minneapolis area. So obviously the overwhelming majority of refugees are law-abiding. They love America. They're happy to be in America. So anything that enhances people's concerns or sense of security and makes everyone feel more comfortable is not a bad thing. I mean, foreigners being vetted in the United States, extreme vetting, is actually not new. It's not a new thing. You know, you used to be, for example, that you had to put in forms if you wanted to come to the United States whether you had were pro-communist or a member of a Nazi organization or whatever. So these are not new things, but obviously whatever is done needs to be done in a way which makes sense and makes actually things better and not worse.
If you were to offer Mr. Trump some recommendations for a cohesive counterterrorism strategy, what would you say?
I would say there's an urgent need to prioritize what one is doing. The U.S. is basically deeply involved in six semi-hot wars. The U.S. can't do it all. We certainly want to destroy the scourge of Salafi jihadist terrorism as much as possible. We want to work with allies in the region to do that. But the United States can't do it all, and we need to prioritize what makes most sense, what is going to give us the best result, the biggest bang for our buck.
Ambassador Alberto Fernandez is former director of the State Department's Center for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed Elshenawy.
While the Zika virus is getting a lot of attention these days, a new study warns that West Nile virus may be more deadly than previously thought. West Nile may even pose a danger to people years after they've apparently recovered. The findings were released at the meeting of the American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene in Atlanta. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
West Nile virus first appeared in the United States in New York City in 1999. Since then, there have been about 43,000 known cases and at least 1,700 deaths. Dr. Christy Murray is the principal author of the study. She's assistant dean for the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine and Texas Children's Hospital.
West Nile Nile virus is a virus that's spread by mosquitoes. It's actually in the same virus family as Zika virus and dengue and yellow fever. So it's kind of a distant cousin from those viruses. Birds are what carry the virus and infect the mosquitoes, and the mosquitoes can go on to infect people.
About 80% of the people infected with West Nile virus show little or no symptoms. Others are not as fortunate.
It's more around the 20% that will develop either a febrile type disease, or they'll progress even further and have much more severe disease, what we call neuroinvasive disease, which includes encephalitis and meningitis.
A small study in the state of Colorado first raised warnings about West Nile virus, but there was too little information to make any major conclusions. So Murray and her colleagues looked at more than 4,100 cases that occurred in Texas between 2002 and 2012. They focused on so-called acute deaths that occurred within 90 days after infection, and on patients who died months or even years later.
In our own study in Houston, we actually had the largest, longest followed cohort of patients in the country. And once they had West Nile, it seemed like their health just rapidly declined, and that we saw people dying from especially kidney disease at a younger age than what we would have otherwise expected. And we ended up finding that 40% of our patients were developing kidney disease after West Nile. So that was a really big concern for us.
Of the more than 4,100 cases in Texas, nearly 560 people died.
It is true that there is a 2 times greater risk of dying at an age that's earlier than what you would expect for the general population. But then when we teased it down a little bit more, what we found was that if you're under age 60, that risk was even higher. Once you got past age 60, it kind of almost mirrored what was expected in the general population.
Murray says they then took a closer look at the causes of death, especially for those under age 60.
The one that really stood out to us the most was that increased risk of death for kidney disease. It actually was 11 times greater than what we would expect to see in the general population, and that it can lead to premature mortality.
It's not clear why those under 60 may be more at risk. Currently, there's no real treatment for West Nile virus, aside from taking fluids and pain relievers. Vaccine research is underway, but slow. The market for such a vaccine is seen as small, but that could change with the latest findings. West Nile virus cases are reported in every U.S. state except Alaska and Hawaii. The virus is able to spread far and wide because it's carried by birds. Mosquitoes bite the birds and then pass West Nile along to humans. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll examine Beyond the Storm, treating the powerless and the powerful in Mobutu's Congo Zaire, a book written by Dr. William Close and Dr. Matudila Malonga, a Congolese physician who co-discovered Ebola in 1976. We'll also discuss the latest developments in the Democratic Republic of Congo on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.